You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Louise Beale. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the head of the military wing of the Palestinian Islamist group Hamas is killed in an Israeli airstrike. We get the latest from our man in Ramallah. Scandinavian airline SAS is struggling financially, worse than ever before. We look at the Nordic skies and find out who will be the winners and who the losers.
The situation of SAS is very serious, and the big question now in Sweden is, are they going to survive this week or not?
And staying in the north, a court case causes tensions between Russia and Norway. An activist who has promoted the culture of northwestern Russia's indigenous people is accused of high treason with support from Norwegian special services.
The Norwegian foreign minister has been following this case because in the accusations against Gusev, it is written that he has been working on behalf of the Norwegian intelligence service. So this is a very serious statement.
We'll also discuss the winners of Monocle's third annual Soft Power Survey and check in with Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound, who is attending the Paris Photo 2012 fair. Lots still to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Workers and demonstrators across 22 European Union countries are staging demonstrations against rising unemployment and austerity measures. International travel links have been badly affected as a result, with airlines and Eurostar suffering from cancellations. These passengers were stranded in Brussels after Belgian rail workers joined in.
We got the train from London to Brussels last night, and I'm just trying to find out now what's happening.
Why did they tell you about your tickets?
Well, we don't know. We've got they've had to queue up to go in and find out, but I think there's a big queue.
We tried to come here to the station, and we just know right now that our train was cancelled. I don't know what we will do right now, because we need to go to Amsterdam, and we have already booked our hotel there, and we don't know what to do.
Bearing in mind that some of the worst violence has occurred in Greece and Spain over those austerity measures both countries have had to face, the EU Commissioner of Monetary and Economic Affairs, Olli Rehn, announced today that there would be no further escalation of disciplinary fiscal measures against Spain for the time being.
The government and the Spanish people are making significant efforts to ensure the sustainability of public finances. This involves hard choices and sacrifices for many parts of the population. Progress is being made, even if the situation faced by many Spaniards remains very difficult.
Meanwhile, the British Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, on a visit to Paris, has said that the European continent is still recovering from what he called an economic cardiac arrest. He stressed that politicians deciding the European budget must keep in mind the sense of anxiety that has lingered in many European countries since the economic crisis started in 2008.
People are now very, very sensitive, quite rightly, for how money, public money, is spent, where it's spent, by whom, and for what purpose. We have had a major cardiac arrest in our economy back in 2008, from which we're still recovering as a continent. Our economies are still vulnerable, are still fragile, and in those circumstances, we think we need to be very, very disciplined about the level of increase in the European Union budget.
Other news now, and Israel has today killed the military commander of Hamas, Ahmad al-Jabrari, in an airstrike on the Gaza Strip, bringing the two sides to the brink of a possible new war. Egypt's foreign minister, Mohamed Khamel Amer, has condemned the strike and urged an immediate end to attacks on Gaza. The Nobel Peace Laureate and Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has today said that Burma is still on its way towards democratisation and reconciliation. She was speaking in New Delhi and said she hoped India would stand by Burma in their last push towards democracy.
I would like to take this opportunity to say that we have not yet achieved the goal of democracy. We are still trying, and we hope that in this last, I hope, and most difficult phase, the people of India will stand by us and walk by us as we proceed along the path that they were able to proceed many years before us.
And finally, giant chocolate coins, squeezing people into a minicar and didgeridoo playing will all be pushed to their limits during Guinness World Records Day tomorrow. The 8th annual global celebration of the weird and wacky will see more than 420,000 people attempt to smash old favourites of the record-breaking world, many for charity. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Will you be trying to break any records tomorrow?
Gosh, I'm just starting to think about that.
So many.
Giant chocolate coins. That sounds interesting because yes. I love chocolate.
Well, then that sounds like a good one. Mm. You should go and read up and see what you can do.
Okay.
But thank you very much for that. It's 6 minutes past the hour here. That means it's 22:06 in Moscow, 18:06 in London and 13:06 in New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. We start the programme with a story that is still breaking. The head of the military wing of the Palestinian Islamist group Hamas has been killed in Gaza City in an airstrike. Ahmed Zayed Khalil al-Jabiri died when the car he was travelling in was hit. It's now been reported a series of airstrikes are taking place across Gaza. The attack comes after Israel warned it may step up targeted assassinations following nearly a week of intense rocket fire from Gaza. Jabiri is the most senior Hamas figure to have been killed by Israel for nearly 4 years. Well, joining me on the line now is Monocle's man in Ramallah, Joseph Dana. Joseph, thanks very much for talking to me. Well, first of all, what is the latest? Are there any more airstrikes? Have there been calls for revenge?
Well, there's certainly been calls for revenge. How that revenge is actually going to be played out has not yet come to fruition. What we know now is that most of Gaza, the streets are quiet, but there are continuing airstrikes. In fact, just now coming across the wires, the house of Mahmoud Zawahiri, who was a major Hamas figure, one of the co-founders, is reportedly been targeted in an airstrike, or there was an explosion close to it. So most of the people of Gaza, from what we understand, are kind of taking shelter, hunkering down in their houses, probably preparing for maybe an Israeli ground invasion or at least continued airstrikes through the night, and the airstrikes continue as we speak.
Now, as we were saying, this comes after nearly a week of intense rocket fire from Gaza. After months of a sort of uneasy truce of sorts, why did Hamas decide to sort of kick the Israeli hornet's nest and incur the what could be seen as the inevitable?
That's a very good question. You know, Hamas did attack, or elements in Gaza, rather, attacked an Israeli patrol last week, which led to a kind of outbreak of fresh violence, which has been, you know, kind of sporadic over the past couple of years, for sure. Actually, today, a kind of unofficial truce had settled over Gaza this morning, mediated by the Egyptians, and then kind of out of the blue this afternoon, there was this airstrike. And as you noted, the Israelis have been alluding to the fact that they might go after senior Hamas militants and operatives in an escalation, so to speak, across the border in an attempt to stifle this rocket fire. And so that's exactly what we have playing out right now.
And as you say, I mean, it is still panning out. What do you think or what can you predict is going to happen? Can we expect more in terms of continuing Israeli action?
Well, we can definitely, the Israelis have made no qualms about the fact that they are going to continue these airstrikes, and they have not ruled out a ground invasion into Gaza. Now, this is coming at probably one of the worst times in the region that you can imagine. The Egyptians have a new leadership under the president of Mohamed Morsi, who is himself from the Muslim Brotherhood, which Hamas is an offshoot of. And this is after the Arab Spring, and so the reaction from the region is going to be incredibly crucial as to how this thing unfolds. You know, there is a bit of violence going on the northern border of Israel with Syria. There was a number of protests last night in Jordan, and so everything kind of around the area is very, very unstable, and now the Israelis are opening up really what could be a hornet's nest if this leads into a ground invasion or something similar to what happened during Operation Cast Lead, which was the last significant military conflict between Israel and Gaza in 2009.
So we could really, in theory, be potentially looking at another war.
Indeed. Well, I mean, it looks like a war right now. Airstrikes, kind of taking out the most senior Hamas operative in Gaza is a significant escalation. And Hamas, the border between Gaza and Sinai has been relatively porous. And so they might have some very significant rocket capabilities now that could hit Tel Aviv or Haifa or one of an Israeli city inside of the central part of the country. And they are saying that they will retaliate, in full, in kind, to the airstrikes that happened today. And so this could really spiral out of control.
And these airstrikes today, I mean, they were obviously designed to impair the command and control chain of the Hamas leadership. The man who's been killed, al-Jabari, was a significant figure, wasn't he? I mean, what more do we know about him?
He's a very interesting figure. He was actually a member of the Fatah party in the 80s, and he kind of went over to Hamas. He is really a guy that has a lot of experience. The Israelis are claiming that he's been running the Hamas military operations for at least 8 years. And there is a certain vacuum of experience among the Hamas leadership in Gaza. And so by taking him out, they are going right to the heart of Hamas's military capability. He was also responsible, at least the Israelis are saying, responsible for the kidnapping and release of the captive Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. And so this is a guy that's really a crucial figure in the entire kind of Hamas governing structure.
And with him gone, is there an obvious replacement? Are there other figures that can sort of step into the breach? Or is this, really a significant loss, I suppose, for them?
My feeling is that this is a very significant blow to the Hamas leadership. The leadership has gone on the kind of international airwaves, especially on Al Jazeera, saying that there will be someone that will fill his void, but that they don't want to announce this figure, due to a fear of him being attacked in an airstrike as well. But the feeling really that's coming out of Gaza is that this is an incredible blow that the Hamas leadership is going to have to respond to in kind or probably elevate the situation with Israel. And so you kind of have to wonder a little bit why this attack is coming right now, given the volatility of the region and the possible capabilities that Hamas has to strike back.
Okay, Joseph Dana, Monocle's man in Ramallah, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back with a look at what Brazil is losing due to its reams of red tape.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It is 2014 in Istanbul, 1814 here in London, and 1014 a.m. in Los Angeles. We're heading to Brazil now, where a U.S.-based investment bank has announced it's shutting down its equity research unit in Brazil due to tax and regulatory hurdles. Raymond James Financial says it's easier to operate in Argentina than it is in Brazil. They're not the first organisation to complain about the so-called Brazil cost, a combination of high taxes, red tape and infrastructure problems. So how much of an issue is this becoming? Well, to discuss that, I'm joined by Joseph Leahy, a correspondent for the FT in Brazil, who's currently in Sao Paulo. Joseph, thanks very much for joining me. Now, I read that there are apparently now 90 different taxes in Brazil. The World Bank says it takes on average 2,600 hours a year to fill out a tax return. Is all this regulation already quite a significant problem in Brazil and hurting the economy?
Well, it is a huge problem here in Brazil, and it's something, as you mentioned in your introduction there, that there's even a name for, which is the custo Brazil, or the Brazil cost. There's hundreds of different stories about how much red tape there is here in Brazil. For instance, businesses tell me that there are two changes per hour to tax procedures and laws in Brazil. And for that, you have to employ an army of lawyers just to, and tax accountants just to keep up with the tax side of things. And we're only talking about tax. There's hundreds of other areas of law. You know, for instance, importing stuff. There's different procedures covering imports, banking. There are taxes on and procedures for bringing money into the country. The list is endless.
I mean, it just seems crazy. Why the need for all of this regulation? And surely it must be hurting Brazil's economy. I mean, as we've seen, Raymond James Financial is pulling out. It must be a significant problem.
It's a huge barrier to entry for businesses coming to Brazil. It's almost impossible to come to Brazil and start trying to do business from, you know, literally landing at the port and then trying to do business. Raymond James Financial found, you have to come in here and try and set up an office, and then you have to get a certain level of scale to be able to cope with it. And it's not as though this is a problem that Brazil isn't worried about as well. The government itself is trying to reform laws, trying to lift some of these taxes, some of the most burdensome taxes itself, to try and make Brazil more competitive, because the government is aware at the same time that this is a problem. But this is a legacy of decades of law, and also of the difficulty of actually of changing laws in Brazil because of the complexity of the politics in Brasilia, where you have ruling coalitions that are often made up of more than 10 parties at a time, and often it's difficult to get everyone to agree.
Now, in the case of Raymond James Financial, is the problem just infrastructure, or are problems on the equity market playing a role?
Yes, well, you know, Raymond James' stated reason for doing this was the tax and regulatory hurdles. But of course, the Brazilian equity market is going through one of its worst periods in terms of new equity issuance since 2005, which is saying something, because in 2005 it wasn't such a dynamic market. And I think the bad equity markets, we've seen that in other countries as well. It's not just Brazil, so it's possible that, you know, their timing wasn't particularly fortunate. But at the same time, having a small operation here is going to make it even harder for them to survive when business isn't good, given this Brazil cost that we've just spoken about.
And as you say, the government must be keen in Brazil to sort out this Brazil cost, because, you know, Brazil was seen as an emerging economy. They've got the World Cup in 2014, the Olympics in 2016. It's not helpful to have this kind of negative vibe.
No, that's right. And they, as I mentioned, they are trying to do things. They've recently lifted taxes on the tax that you pay. It's a social welfare payment that employers must pay on top of salaries. Just to give you an idea, in Brazil, the level of fees and taxes that are on salaries end up doubling the amount that employees must pay each worker. So, for instance, if you're paid 500 reais per month in your hand, your employer is paying another 500 to the government. These sorts of things are incredibly burdensome for employers, and also affect the quality of employment in the country. And to give you another idea of the sort of red tape that you face in Brazil, I personally, as a foreigner coming into the country, I have to obviously get a visa, work visa, and extend it. And I've been in the process of extending my visa now for 2 to 3 months, and I've been told that it could take me a year to finish the process. And in the meantime, when I leave the country, I have to come back in with a tourist visa. So every time I leave the country, I have to get a tourist visa to come back. And this is not an unusual story. It's very difficult to get work visas for Brazil for foreigners as well, which is affecting Brazil's competitiveness at a time when it needs skilled labour in areas such as the petroleum industry.
Well, good luck with your visa struggles. Joseph Leahy, Financial Times correspondent in Brazil, thank you for joining me. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back with a court case that is causing tension between Russia and Norway.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Louise Beale. A court case against a Russian national is causing tensions between Norway and Russia. Ivan Mosev worked as the head of an organisation promoting the culture of northwestern Russia's indigenous Pomor people. Now he is accused of high treason with support from Norwegian special services based on new legislation that passed in Russia recently. If found guilty, he could end up in jail for up to 20 years. Both Norway and Amnesty International have announced that they are following this case very carefully. To talk more about it and about the consequences for Russian-Norwegian relations, Monocle's Marcus Hippe called Thomas Nielsen, editor of Barents Observer. Thomas first explained what Ivan Mosev is exactly accused of.
Ivan Mosev is accused of high treason, also of creating ethnic hatred in this northwestern corner of Russia.
And what exactly are these accusations based on?
Well, Ivan Mosev, he has been a person that over the last 20 years have built people-to-people cooperation with Norway's northern region. He is a Pomor that is not an indigenous people, but it's a group of Russian settlers who have been in the area for hundreds of years around the White Sea. And these people in the old days, they were trading with Norway, they had their culture exchange, etc. That trade and culture exchange was stopped during the Soviet period. But now, after the breakup of the Soviet Union, they have tried to re-establish these links with Norway, and only in the sphere of culture and history and so on. But obviously, there are some forces in Russia that don't like the Pomors. They accuse them of doing separatism from Russia. They accuse them of having a secret relation with, actually what they write in the case file is that they are working on behalf of the Norwegian intelligence service to destabilize the situation in northwest Russia. But as we have seen it, as an observer here from the Norwegian media side, the only thing they have been doing over all these years is re-establishing trade and cultural links with the northern part of Norway.
Well, what do you say about these separatist accusations, considering that according to reports, Ivan Mosev has actually suggested that there would be a Republic of Pomors?
In the case files, they write that he has suggested that there should be a republic. Ivan Mosev, he denies such kind of accusations totally. But he says that he wants to have some more cultural support for the Pomors in the region. But he is a Russian. He cooperates very well with the Russian authorities over all these years. But it is the Russian security service, the FSB, that now accuse him of high treason. But when we speak to people in the Arkhangelsk region that are not Pomors, they say that it's totally ununderstandable for them why he is accused of high treason. That is Article 275 in the Russian Criminal Code. And he actually can face 12 to 20 years in prison for that work. And both for most people in northern Norway and in the Arkhangelsk region in northwest Russia, this is unbelievable charges.
And considering how long time Ivan Mosev has already been doing this work to promote the Pomor culture, why has Russia's Federal Security Service, FSB, started targeting him now?
It is very important for us to remember that from November 1st this year, the Russian law on the high treason has been changed. It has been amended. So today it has a much wider or broader definition of what they could call or accuse some citizens for a high treason. Well, this is a part of new Russia. There are changes in Russia that do not exactly support building of civil society, non-governmental organizations, and so on. So the Russian Security Service has a much broader target today of who and why they could accuse someone for high treason.
Amnesty International is following this case very carefully, but have we heard anything from Norway's foreign ministry yet?
The Norwegian foreign minister has been following this case very briefly because in the accusations against Museev, it is written that he has been working on behalf of the Norwegian intelligence service. So this is a very serious statement in the bilateral cooperation between Norway and Russia. And the foreign ministry of Norway has clearly said that this accusation comes as a big surprise. But we are now awaiting for the trial to start. That will probably come by the end of November sometime. And then we'll follow the case. But Norway is deeply following this.
Do you think that some kind of a Norwegian intervention would actually change anything that's happening there in Russia regarding this case?
I do think so, yes. My experience covering different kind of similar cases in Russia is that if there is totally silence about a case or an accusation of treason or something involving the secret service agencies in Russia, then it's much easier for the court to convict the person. So I think the more Amnesty International, the more the media, and the more other countries' governments and authorities like Norway are following the case, the more difficult it will be to convict him. Because high treason, this is not the issue in this case.
You already said earlier that if convicted, Ivan Moseev could face 12 to 20 years in prison. How do you see the trial against Mr. Moseev playing out?
The court was supposed to meet this Monday, but they couldn't do so because Mr. Moseev is in hospital for some stomach problems. Now it's postponed for 2 weeks. But this is a local court that will be the first place to hear the case. And Kangelsk is not famous for having a fair court. The rule of law is not exactly the label we will give the courts there. But Russia has a very good court system also, so everyone can take the court to a higher court, either on the regional level or even bring it in for the Supreme Court in Moscow. And Mr. Moseev has said that, okay, he might be convicted in Arkhangelsk, but he will bring the case further on all the way to the Supreme Court in Moscow if necessary.
And to which extent should we see this as one individual case, or should we just simply look at this in a wider context?
That is too early to speculate on. The law was changed from November 1st, and there are certain indications that this is just the beginning. But let's hope that it will be a separate case and that it will not develop. But there are changes in Russia now. Way too early to make any conclusions, but I think absolutely we should say that we are worried and we should follow the situation.
That was Monocle's Marcus Hippie talking to Thomas Nielsen, editor of Barents Observer. Now, before the news headlines and a look at the financial turbulence the Nordic airline companies are facing, let's have some music from Scandinavia. This is Music in My Mind by Lindstrom and Christabel. Was Music in My Mind by Lindstrom and Christabel. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll discuss whether airline SAS will ever survive its financial troubles. We'll also check in with our culture editor, Robert Bound, who is in Paris, and we'll talk soft power. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Workers and demonstrators across 22 European Union countries are staging demonstrations against rising unemployment and austerity measures. International travel links have been badly affected as a result, with with airlines and Eurostar suffering from cancellations. Meanwhile, the British Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, on a visit to Paris, has said that the European continent is still recovering from what he called an economic cardiac arrest, and stressed that politicians deciding the budget in Europe must keep in mind the sense of anxiety that has lingered in many countries there since the economic crisis started in 2008. Israel has today killed the military commander of Hamas, Ahmed al-Jabari, in an airstrike on the Gaza Strip, bringing the two sides to the brink of a possible new war. Egypt's foreign minister has condemned the strike and urged an immediate end to attacks on Gaza. And the Nobel Peace Laureate and Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has today said that Burma is still on its way towards democratisation and reconciliation. She was speaking in New Delhi and said she hoped India would stand by Burma in their last push towards democracy. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
This is indeed Monocle 24, and this is Midori House. We're coming to you live from London. Now, the problems facing the Scandinavian airline SAS seem to be getting worse by the day and are threatening to engulf it. SAS has lost money nearly every year for the past decade, and it's now warned its staff they have until Sunday to accept deep cuts to pay in pensions, or else it could go bust. But in the last 24 hours, the head of a union representing some 500 Danish SAS pilots has rejected the savings plan that was already unpopular with staff. One analyst has predicted the airline will cease to exist in 12 months' time. Well, I'm joined on the line now by Ole Zachrisson, the business editor of Svenska Dagbladet in Stockholm. Hello, and thank you very much for joining me. So, we're hearing one analyst predicting that SAS will cease to exist in 12 months' time. Do you agree?
I would be surprised if SAS ceased to exist within a year. I think that the Swedish government and the Danish government and the Norwegian government, they are trying to do everything in their power to avoid that situation, because they're going to have a massive discussion if SAS went bust. And therefore, I think that it's very unlikely that they will go bust, but it can happen.
Do you think they can push through this savings scheme, though?
I mean, it's a very, very tight deadline that they put to themselves. They have to sign these agreements with the trade unions on Sunday at the latest, as you said. And this is without comparison, basically, in Swedish work history, actually, when it comes to how employment conflicts are handled. This is a very unique situation that the company is trying to push the trade unions to agree with this kind of with a deal which is so big and so drastic, and to push them to accept that in just 1 week. This is without exception, actually.
Well, Ole, joining us now is Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, who's in the studio with me too. And, well, Tyler, let me first ask you, I suppose. I mean, 12 months' time, this prediction that perhaps SAS could be over, do you agree with that?
I think it's definitely looking like that, because or it certainly will not be in the current form as we know it. We've obviously seen the proposal for the disposal of Widerøe, which is, of course, their commuter airline in Norway. So maybe we're going to be looking at some type of breakup. I would imagine, given certainly just the importance of exports, if you look at not just Sweden, but of course if we look at Denmark and also Norway, do we see someone else picking up the long haul brand? I think it would be very, very difficult to see that region without global connectivity between Stockholm, Copenhagen, and then of course we've also seen the Norwegians as well. All of the news over the last week about Norwegian going long haul, which of course is is a big threat. If I may, I wanted to ask you, just when we're talking about Norway, do you think we could see a situation as well? Danes fiscally challenged, Sweden, of course, a bit of belt tightening. But of course, there's a neighbor who has lots of cash. And I'm wondering if there's also a situation where Norway would say, look at, we're going to absorb this. We'll keep the Scandinavian name. But you know, for the good of the neighborhood, we believe we have to look after and we need a carrier.
Actually, I would say that the opposite is more likely, actually. There has been signals that the Norwegian government has had the sternest view on SAS, hence that they don't want to save it, because the Danish government and the Swedish government are fighting higher rates of unemployment, and also the therefore, a lot of people think that it's actually the Danish government and the Swedish government that are most favorable of saving SAS. So I don't think that the Norwegian government would try to acquire the brand or try to make it survive. I think that they are pretty happy with having this low price competitor Norwegian, which is also more of a Norwegian name to it, and maybe they are pretty happy from the Norwegian side with having a bigger and stronger Norwegian and also kind of regional carriers in Norway.
And Ole, speaking actually of that airline Norwegian, I mean, how much business have they taken away from SAS? And are they sort of one of SAS's biggest problems?
They are, of course, and together with Ryanair, which is also flying heavily into Scandinavia. And Swedish people are a bit cheap, you know. They are always looking for a bargain. And SAS haven't been able to actually motivate those higher prices that they have had. So, they have, both Norwegian and Ryanair, they have taken big chunks of the market share of SAS. And SAS, they have tried so many different strategies to tackle this. They have tried to put the prices down themselves. They have tried to make them look like more of a luxury brand, but none of these strategies have succeeded.
Ole, just before we go, from a patriotism point of view, as you said, maybe the Norwegians are very happy sitting in Oslo. They're very, they're thrilled that that Mr. Bjørn Kjos, the CEO of the airline, has come up with something which has, famous Norwegians on the tails of their plane. They can all feel good about it. So maybe is the other direction that we end up that. That potentially Stockholm says, look at, we'll take, our portion of our aircraft, we'll operate our own long haul routes where we feel, we need to be flying into New York. We need to be connected into China, et cetera. And we could then see a dedicated Swedish airline, which has nothing to do with the Scandinavian brand anymore. It just becomes, an aircraft with, a big yellow cross on the tail on a blue background.
It's a possible scenario, but I think that one thing that you shouldn't underestimate is how strong the support of the Swedish industry, the classic Swedish industry, is of SAS. For example, we have a very wealthy family here, the Wallenberg family.
Never heard of them.
And they are both big owners of SAS and also very big like supporters, and all the kind of the business elite of Sweden, for them it's a lot of prestige to keep a national carrier.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to leave there. But Ole Zachrisson, the business editor of Svenska Dagbladet in Stockholm, and Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé, thank you very much for joining me. We'll be right back after this with a look at which countries ruled and why on Monocle's soft power survey.
On Monocle's culture show, we want to be like the fabled Hydra, one of the great monsters of Greek myth, but in a good way. Listen to one fascinating story and two more eagerly pop up to replace it. So it's only scary if you're frightened of the following sorts of things. Reports from all over the world on art, books, magazines, media, music, film, publishing, advertising, and photography. Or if you're terrified of beautifully performed intimate live music sessions from some of our favourite acts recorded in our performance space right here at Midori House. It's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. It premieres on Mondays at 1900 London time, and frankly, it's the heroic Hercules that defeats the evil Hydra of radio boredom. Join us and enjoy the legend.
London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, New York, and Toronto. On October the 19th, Monocle opened the doors to its newest shop. Chock full of our regular goodies from Porter bags, Ettinger leather goods, 2013 Diaries by Marks, and Hakisan ceramic wine cups. Check out all of our collaboration products or flip through the latest issues of the magazine. Find the perfect gifts for Christmas or just a treat for yourself. Visit us on College Street in Toronto or at our other shops around the world. And remember, you can sign up to our weekly bulletin at monocle.com to find out about all of the newest products as they hit the shelves.
You are listening to Midori House. The time is 18:41 here in London. Now, in the latest edition of the Monocle magazine, we once again rank countries based on the soft power they exercise. It's the third annual survey looking at how countries have put an academic theory into concrete policy. Well, joining me now to tell us who's made the list is Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck here in the studio, and our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield is on the line from Kemi in Finland. Thank you both. Good to see you. Andrew, first of all, well, I mean, tell us, who's made the list? Who's top? And any surprises in there?
Well, I don't think dramatic surprises. There's certainly been a big shift around. What we look at, there are two kind of levels of soft power. There's kind of a deep soft power, which is really to do with your the national psyche almost. There's something about your country that's unchanged, whatever happens by recent events, and there's nothing topical that kind of nudges it along. So, for example, Brazil, there's something very deep-seated in people's perceptions of Brazil. Brazil doesn't need to be kind of it marching its armies around the world to get its way. It just has a kind of gentle diplomacy that is very winning. So people like Brazilians, they have a respect for everything from its popular culture, its sport and football and like, through to these days, even its way of doing government. People, you know, they like Dilma Rousseff. They understand that she's representing a very modern nation. But then there are other countries which are nudged along by the kind of the more superficial elements of soft power. So Spain is kind of pushed down a little bit because events have overtaken it a little bit. So it's caught up with the euro crisis, of course. We shouldn't, in some senses, dent its soft power. But it does, because what happens is, you know, that the countries now, not even sure whether it wants to be a country in some parts. You know, we have Catalonia, we have the Basque region saying, should we break away? And it's very difficult for a country to have a clear narrative about soft power and about its place in the world when it's actually quite internal looking. And we've, you know, that's something we also highlight for the Dutch. That's been an ongoing problem. 20 years ago, the Dutch were admired around the world. Everyone thought of them as liberal, you know, on top of the game, that they were a country that people went to see their national institutions. Now they've been, you know, so introspective for so long that they've kind of lost some of their soft power edge.
And Steve, when you've looked at the list, are there any, I suppose, surprises for you from in comparison to last year?
Yes, there's one big surprise, and that's the winner, which is Britain or the UK or Great Britain or whatever it is you want to call it, which is one of those interesting things that, you know, despite the fact that Britain has amazing soft power, we still can't even work out what the country's called. It's sort of surprising that they've won in a sense, because there's a lot of things, you know, this government perhaps isn't doing very well, and the cuts to the BBC World Service aren't particularly smart. But we saw them have a fantastic Olympics. While there are cuts to the BBC, it's still, and obviously it's going through certain issues now, it's still enormously influential around the world. And it still has football, and it still has the Queen, and it still has James Bond. All these things that if you're in Sierra Leone or you're in Shanghai, you know about Britain and give you, on the whole, a sort of a decent feeling about the place.
And Steve, I mean, you mentioned the Olympics because obviously that was an enormous event and of enormous importance, I suppose, for Great Britain this year. Is that therefore something that we'll see in the future for Brazil? Is that affecting its standing?
It could do, yes, only if they do it right. Just because you hold a sporting event doesn't mean it's necessarily going to help you. Think back 2 years ago to when India hosted the Commonwealth Games. It was an absolute disaster. They couldn't get things finished on time. Things fell down. There was a problem with sewage at one stage. So only if you actually do it right does it make a difference. And Brazil's big challenge is to get the infrastructure fixed. So improve its airports, improve its roads, and make sure that the experience for people going there and the experience they see on TV is a positive one.
And Andrew, would you say that currently at the moment in the world, soft power has never really been more relevant?
Oh, undoubtedly. In fact, even as a term, I was just listening the other day to a programme where the term was being used very kind of freely and it was understood what it means. And I think that we've found that over even the past 3 years that when we've knocked on ministry doors, that there are people now who say, oh yeah, we've been really interested in soft power. And certainly after the last couple of surveys, we've had calls from governments around the world saying, actually, we want to know how we get involved with your soft power survey. We're really, you know, looking at this as a tool. And it, as we said in your introduction, it came from an academic idea from Joseph Nye, and it's kind of got wings. It's taken off. People are really thinking about how they do this. The interesting thing, as Steve was highlighting there, is, you know, that yes, there are some things that government can do that to do with infrastructure and how you present yourself, but there's a self-governing element of soft power which governments, you know, can have nothing to do with, and if they do, it's at their peril. And that's things like, you know, pop music. You know, we've seen this extraordinary story of, you know, Psy and Gangnam Style, which is a bit overplayed now, but it is an interesting example of how a single song can make people think differently about a country. And you see that with the UK. An incredibly successful music industry, independent really of what the government does. You know, in fact, many people would feel the government hasn't supported it, but that sells Britain around the world. You know, and you know, even bands that we don't like. You know, I just saw a newspaper thing saying, you know, One Direction, this pop creation, but they're the biggest band in the US. Now that's interesting that thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of young people are probably going onto websites and finding out a little bit about the UK and thinking a little bit more about it. But that happens at every level of music and of culture, whether it's, you know, plays going to Broadway, whether it's actors going to work in Hollywood. There is a cultural currency about the UK that's very powerful.
And just briefly, I mean, you've touched on it a bit, but what is the aim of this index?
I think our aim is to put the spotlight on something we felt that was very potent within foreign ministries that was actually nobody was really kind of surveying. And I think also to kind of underline its importance. You know, we talk here at Monocle a lot about the significance, for example, of having good diplomatic missions. Lots of countries are closing their embassies, saying, actually, we don't need to have an embassy. We can run it from some little office in the back of beyond, or we can have our diplomats working off laptops. They don't need a building to go to. We're saying the opposite. We're saying, actually, the institutions that you wrap around yourself as a country, as a government, are really important. You should be investing in good embassies. You should care about the cultural institutions that represent you. And that's the only way that countries can be successful in the modern world.
Okay, Andrew Tuck, Monocle's editor, and our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who is in Kemi in Finland. Thank you very much for joining me. And on Monocle 24's website, you'll be able to see a special soft power video. It's currently up there now. Here's a little taster.
Monocle's third soft power survey is an attempt to push the debate on where soft power comes from and how to use it. And with the current shifts in the power balance, never has it been more relevant.
Continuing its steady rise, Turkey has broken into our soft power survey's top 20 for the first time.
So go to Monocle24's website and you'll be able to see that. You're listening to Midori House. Now, we'll soon check in with yet another Monocle man, our culture editor, Robert, who is in Paris, attending the Paris Photo 2012 Fair. But before that, music from the same direction. This is Cherry Blossom Girl by Air.
Thank you.
That was Cherry Blossom Girl by Air. You're listening to Midori House with me, Louise Beale. It is 7.53 in the morning in Auckland, 18.53 here in London and 12.53 in Mexico City. Now, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, is in Paris for Paris Photo 2012. The event was created in 1996 and is one of the most prestigious fairs dedicated to photography in the world. Well, to tell us more, we do have Rob on the line from Paris. Hello, good evening to you, Rob.
Hi, Louise. How are you?
Very well, thank you very much. So just tell me, when did you arrive in Paris?
Well, I got here at midday today. It was early train time, and then Zoom, and then straight into the world, of millions of photographs. So my eyes are bulging.
And just give us a sense for anyone who's never been. I mean, what's it like? Tell me, what can you see? Describe it to us.
Well, as you said in your intro there, it's the Grand Palais. So it's kind of right in the museum heartland of Paris, and it's kind of lucky, I guess, this amazing venue under the big, huge kind of wrought iron glass roof at the Grand Palais. It's its second year here, and I think all the gallerists and the curators that I've spoken to at this fair kind of are really sort of digging the new venue. I think it was somewhere before, which is a little bit unsexy, both for sales and for sort of the curatorial elements. So it looks wonderful. And then I'm standing, in fact, at the moment at a bar overlooking the whole fair, and there's 150 galleries representing here. So thousands of different photographers covered by 150 galleries from sort of Utrecht to Tokyo to San Francisco. So I've been scooting around and trying to sort of get a measure of what's selling and kind of what some of the trends are.
It sounds pretty wonderful, actually. So, as you say, I mean, what is selling? What are the trends? What are the highlights from this year?
Well, I think actually the highlights, there are some wonderful things. So the highlight for me is more of a curatorial thing than a straight kind of a mishmash or a sort of greatest hits from a gallery. I was speaking to Nick at Paradise Row, which is a London gallery, and they're showing some of the their frieze show that they showed at the gallery in London, and they've got sort of half of that here. So despite the fact it's an art fair and it's a booth, they're doing a sort of curated show with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and they've got a very interestingly put together show, and they've actually got both the artists that they're representing here as well, which is quite rare because a lot of photographers and artists don't really want to turn up to the fair. They kind of feel that their work hanging on the walls is enough. They're more fans of biennales, so it's kind of nice. Gagosian have a huge stand, which is very much sort of more of a greatest hits of sort of contemporary photography, Diane Arbus and various other things, some nice portraits of Warhol with Basquiat and things you might expect from Gagosian. So it's quite a broad range of stuff.
And I mean, it sounds like there's a really lovely atmosphere. Is that what makes Paris Photo so special, or why is it sort of, why do people who go love it so much?
Well, I'm trying to, yes, exactly. That's what I'm trying to do, Louise, is I'm trying to bring you into the bar atmosphere up here. I think people love it. I think people dig it because it does have a sort of specialty. Obviously, there's lots of photography within contemporary art, which we're used to seeing in Basel and at Frieze and various places around the world. But I think people like the specificity of it being all stuff that is either photography or riffs on photography. So I kind of think that it attracts a certain crowd. It's kind of a contemporary art crowd, but there's more photographers here than there's more photographers attending Harry Photo than there are artists attending something like Frieze, I'd say.
And just very briefly, what's for you your favourite so far?
Well, as I say, I really love the Paradise Row show. But two extra things, or one extra thing that's worth mentioning, is sort of split into three, and that's three museums which have got big photography collections are doing a show of their recent acquisitions, which is kind of cool because it kind of shows what's been on their shopping list over the last couple of years. That's LACMA in Los Angeles, where Paris Photo is actually headed for its kind of breakout art fair in April. MoMA in New York and the Photo Museum Winterthur in Switzerland. So these three places are kind of showing the stuff that they bought over the last couple of years, which is kind of interesting. It's kind of a proper sort of curated survey show of stuff other than just stuff that sells. So
okay.
So yeah, there's a bit of both.
Well, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, in Paris. It sounds wonderful. Enjoy it. And thank you very much for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks to our producers, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augustus Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.